The received wisdom has it that Dr. Murray was perplexed, even vaguely irritated. It said that he vowed, out of all his lexicographic knowledge, to take a leaf from Francis Bacon, who in 1624 had written in English the axiom from the collection of the prophet's saying known as the Hadith, to the effect that if the mountain will not come to Mahomet, then Mahomet must go to the mountain. For it said that he promptly wrote to Dr. Minor, his letter supposedly reading as follows: "You and I have now known each other through correspondence for fully 17 years, and it's a sad fact that we've never met. Perhaps it's never proved convenient for you to travel. Maybe it's been too expensive. But while it's difficult indeed for me to leave the work of the scriptorium even for one day, I've long wanted to meet you, and may I perhaps suggest that I come to visit you? If this is convenient, perhaps you might suggest a day in a train, and if convenient for me, I'll telegraph the time of my expected arrival." Dr. Minor supposedly wrote back promptly, saying that he would of course be delighted to receive the editor, that he was so sorry that physical circumstances, he didn't elaborate, had hitherto made it impossible for him to come up to Oxford, and he suggested a number of trains from those listed in the Bradshaw. Murray duly selected a November Wednesday, and a train that, with a change in Reading, was due into the Wellington College railway station shortly after lunch. He telegraphed the details to Crowthorne, wheeled out his faithful black Humber tricycle, and with his white beard blowing over his shoulder in the chilly breeze, set out down the Banbury Road, past the Randolph Hotel, the Ashmolean Museum and Worcester College, and to the up- or London-bound platform at Oxford Station. The journey took just a little over an hour. He was pleasantly surprised, on arriving at Crowthorne, to find a brougham and a liveried coachman waiting for him. His long-held assumption that Minor must be a leisured man of letters was reinforced. Perhaps, he thought to himself, he was even a man of means. The horses clip-clopped through the fog-damp lanes. The magnificent pile of Wellington School lay neatly in the distance, a respectable distance from Crowthorne village itself, which was no more than a cluster of cottages, the piles of lawn leaves smouldering behind them. It was a pretty little place, quiet, well-wooded, rather self-contained. After a couple of miles, the coachman swung the horses into a poplar-lined driveway that climbed a long, low hill. The cottages thinned out and were replaced by a number of small red-brick houses of rather more severe look. Then the horses stopped before an imposing front gate, a pair of towers with a great black-faced clock between and green-painted doors that were being opened by a servant. The editor was perhaps vaguely excited. This must have seemed to him a grand country house in which he was being exceedingly well received, as though expected for a sumptuous afternoon tea, or like someone arriving at Kettleston for luncheon with Lord Curzon. James Murray removed his cap and unbuttoned the Inverness tweed cape that had protected him from the cold. The servant said nothing, but ushered him inside an upper flight of marble stairs. He was swept into a large room with a glowing coal fire and a wall covered with portraits of gaunt-looking men. There was a large oak director's desk, and behind it a portly man of obvious importance. The servant backed out and closed the door. Murray advanced towards the great man, who rose. The editor bowed stiffly and extended his hand. "I, sir, am Dr. James Murray, of the London Philological Society," he said in his finely modulated Scottish voice, "and editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. And you, sir, must be Dr. William Minor. At long last, I'm most deeply honoured to meet you." There was a pause. Then the other man replied, "I regret not, sir. I cannot lay claim to that distinction. I'm the superintendent of the Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum. Dr. Minor is an American, and he's one of our longest-staying inmates. He committed a murder. He's quite insane." Dr. Murray, as the story then continues, was in turn astonished, amazed, and yet filled with sympathetic interest. He begged to be taken to Dr. Minor, a contemporary report has it, and the meeting between the two men of learning who had corresponded for so long, and who now met in such strange circumstances, was an extremely impressive one. The story of this first meeting is, however, no more than an amusing and romantic fiction. It was created by an American journalist named Hayden Church, who lived in London for most of the first half of this century. It first appeared in England in the Strand magazine in September 1915, and then again revised and amplified in the same journal 6 months later. In fact, Church had already tried it out on an American audience, writing anonymously for the Sunday Star in Washington, D.C. in July 1915. The story was splendidly sensationalized, with the kind of lurid, multi-layered headline that has sadly gone almost out of fashion. "American murderer helps write Oxford Dictionary," read the first, extending over all 8 columns of the page. "Mysterious contributor to an English dictionary proved to be a rich American surgeon confined in Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum for a murder committed while he was in a deranged condition. How Sir James Murray, editor of the dictionary, who set out, as he thought, to visit the home of a fellow savant, found himself at the asylum and heard the extraordinary tale, which begins during the American Civil War, when the principal was a surgeon in the Northern Army. Contributor wealthy and now living in America," said his friend. The breathless headline told an even more exhausting story, but one made more than faintly ludicrous by its author's inability or unwillingness to name Minor. In every reference he is simply called Dr. Blank, as in, "And you, sir, must be Dr. Blank, and most honoured to meet you." The story nonetheless went down well with its American audience, which had been given hints and snippets in the years before. The arrest of one of their officers for murder in London not having passed unnoticed at the time, his imprisonment receiving occasional dustings off as new correspondents and new diplomats found their way to the English capital. But the revelation of his work for the dictionary was new, and in this regard Haydon Church had a good old-fashioned scoop. The wires picked the story up. It appeared in papers around the world and as far away as Tianjin, China. But in London it didn't go down so well. Henry Bradley, who by this time had taken over from Murray as editor-in-chief of what was now formally known as the Oxford English Dictionary, took exception to the Strand article. He wrote an angry letter to the Daily Telegraph, complaining of several misstatements of fact, and that the story of Dr. Murray's first interview with Dr. Minor is, so far as its most romantic features are concerned, a fiction. Haydon Church dashed off a spirited reply to Bradley, which the Telegraph, naturally liking a fight, happily published. It contains vague rebuttals, citing only a host of correspondents, some of them of great eminence, but none of whom are named, who had confirmed the major aspects of the story. It pleads limply that I have the best of reasons for believing the account of the meeting between Minor and Murray to be accurate. The oddest part of Church's reply, however, is its enigmatic postscript. "I have just been in communication with one of the most distinguished literary men in England who pointed out that there did not appear in my article what he personally considered the most striking feature of all in the American's history." Strictly true or not, Haydon Church's account of the first meeting turned out to be simply far too good to ignore. It enthralled all England, people said. It took their mind off World War I. 1915, after all, was the year of Ypres, of Gallipoli, of the sinking of the Lusitania, and people were no doubt content to have such a saga as a diversion from the grim realities of the fighting. "No romance," said the Pall Mall Gazette, "is equal to this wonderful story of scholarship in a padded cell." Virtually all subsequent references to the saga of Oxford Dictionary making retell Church's story to a greater or lesser degree. In her justly celebrated biography in 1977 of her grandfather, Miss K.M. Elizabeth Murray retells Church's version of events almost without question, as does Jonathan Green in a more general book on the history of lexicography, published as recently as 1996. Only Elizabeth Knowles, an Oxford University Press editor who became intrigued by the story in the early 1990s, takes a cooler and more detached view. Still, she's clearly perplexed that no definitive account of the first meeting can be found. The patina, applied by decades of good use, has made the legend pleasingly credible. The truth, however, turns out to be only marginally less romantic. It surfaces in a letter that Murray wrote in 1902 to a distinguished friend named Dr. Francis Brown in Boston, and which turned up in a wooden box in the attic of one of William Minor's very few living relations, a retired businessman living in Riverside, Connecticut. The letter appears to be the full and complete original, although it was the exhausting habit of many letter writers of the time to prepare a fair copy of all their outgoing mail, and in so doing occasionally to edit and elide some passages. His first contact with Minor, writes Dr. Murray, came very soon after the beginning of his work on the dictionary, probably 1880 or even 1881. He proved to be a very good reader, who wrote to me often. And, as has already been mentioned, Murray thought only that he must be a retired medical man with plenty of time on his hands. By accident, he continued, my attention was called to the fact that his address, Broadmoor, Crowthorne, Berkshire, was that of a large lunatic asylum. I assumed that, perhaps, he was the medical officer of that institution. But our correspondence was, of course, entirely limited to the dictionary and its materials, and the only feeling I had towards him was that of gratitude for his immense help, with some surprise at the rare and expensive old books that he evidently had access to. This continued for years, until one day between 1887 and 1890, the late Mr. Justin Windsor, librarian of Harvard College, was sitting chatting in my scriptorium, and among other things remarked, "You've given great pleasure to Americans by speaking as you do in your preface of poor Dr. Minor. This is a very painful case." "Indeed," I said with astonishment, "in what way?" Mr. W. was equally astonished to find that in all these years I had corresponded with Dr. Minor, I had neither learned nor suspected anything about him, and he then thrilled me with his story. The great librarian, for Justin Windsor remains one of the grandest figures in all of 19th-century American librarianship, and a formidable historian to boot, then told the story, which Murray then retold to his friend in Boston. Some of the facts are wrong, as facts tend to be when related over a period of years. Murray says that Minor went to Harvard, while in fact he went to Yale, and repeats the probably apocryphal story that he was driven mad by having to witness the execution of two men after a court-martial. He goes on to say that the shooting happened in the Strand, then, unlike now, one of London's more fashionable streets, rather than in the grim purlieus of the Lambeth waterside. But essentially, the story is relayed correctly, after which Murray resumes his own narrative. I was, of course, deeply affected by the story, but as Dr. Minor had never in the least alluded to himself or his position, all I could do was to write to him more respectfully and kindly than before, so as to show no notice of this disclosure, which I feared might make some change in our relations. A few years ago, an American citizen who called on me told me that he had been to see Dr. Minor, and said he'd found him rather low and out of spirits, and urged me to go and see him. I said I shrank from that, because I had no reason to suppose that Dr. Minor thought I knew anything about him personally. He said, "Yes, he does. He's no doubt that you know all about him, and it really would be a kindness if you'd go and see him." I then wrote to Dr. Minor telling him that, and that Mr. I forget the name, who had recently visited him, had told me that a visit from me would be welcome. I also wrote to Dr. Nicholson, the then governor, who warmly invited me, and when I went, drove me from and to the railway station and invited me to lunch, at which he also had Dr. Minor, who I found was a great favourite with his children. I sat with Dr. Minor in his room or cell many hours altogether before and after lunch, and I found him, as far as I could see, as sane as myself, a much cultivated and scholarly man with many artistic tastes and a fine Christian character, quite resigned to his sad lot, and grieved only on account of the restriction it imposed on his usefulness. I learned from the governor, I think, that he has always given a large part of his income to support the widow of the man whose death he so sadly caused, and that she regularly visits him. Dr. Nicholson had a great opinion of him, gave him many privileges, and regularly took distinguished visitors up to his room or cell to see him and his books. But his successor, the present governor, has not shown such special sympathy. The meeting took place in January 1891, 6 years earlier than is favoured by the romantics who repeat the dictionary dinner story. Murray had written to Nicholson asking for permission, and in the letter we can almost feel his childlike, knee-squeezing anticipation of the event. "It'll give me great satisfaction to make the acquaintance of Dr. Minor, to whom the dictionary owes so much, as well as yourself, who have been so kind to him. I shall probably come by the train you name, the 12 from Reading, but have not had time to look up the timetable, or rather to ask my wife to do so, for in such matters I deliver myself automatically into her hands, and she tells me, 'Your train starts so and so, and you will go by such a train, and I will come into the scriptorium and fetch you to get ready 5 minutes before.' I thankfully comply and do my work until the 5 minutes before arrives. It's now abundantly clear that the two men knew each other personally and saw each other regularly for almost 20 years from that date. The first encounter over lunch was to begin a long and firm friendship based both on a wary mutual respect and more particularly on their passionate and keenly shared love for words. For both men, the first sight of the other must have been peculiar indeed, for they were uncannily similar in appearance. Both were tall, thin, and bald. Both had deeply hooded blue eyes, neither using spectacles, though Minor was profoundly myopic. Dr. Minor's nose looks a little hooked. Dr. Murray's finer and more aquiline. Minor has an air of avuncular kindliness. Murray much the same, but with a trace of the severity that might well distinguish a lowland Scot from a Connecticut Yankee. But what was most obviously similar about the men were their beards, in both cases white, long and nicely swallow-tailed, with thick moustaches, sideburns, and ample bugger's grips. Both looked like popular illustrations of Father Time. Boys in Oxford would see Murray tricycling by and call out, "Father Christmas!" at him. True, Dr. Minor's beard had a more ragged and unkempt look about it, doubtless because the arrangements for cutting and washing inside Broadmoor were rather less sophisticated than in the outside world. Murray's beard, on the other hand, was fine and well-combed and shampooed, and looked as though no particle of food had ever been allowed to rest there. Minor's was the more homely, while Murray's was more of a fashion statement. But both were magnificently fecund arrangements. When the beards were added to the other collections of the pair's individual attributes, each must have imagined for a second that he was stepping towards himself in a looking-glass, rather than meeting a stranger. The two men met dozens of times in the next several years. By all accounts, they liked each other, a liking subject only to Dr. Minor's moods, to which Murray became over the years fully sensitive. He often had the foresight to telegraph Nicholson to ask how the patient was. If low and angry, he'd remain in Oxford. If low and likely to be comforted, he'd board the train. When the weather was poor, the men would sit together in Minor's room, a small and practically furnished cell not too dissimilar from a typical Oxford student's room, and just like the room Murray was to be given at Balliol once he was made an honorary fellow. It was lined with bookshelves, all of which were open except for one glass-fronted case that held the rarest of the 16th and 17th century works from which much of the OED work was being done. The fireplace crackled merrily. Tea and Dundee cake were brought in by a fellow inmate whom Minor had hired to work for him, one of the many privileges that Nicholson, like Orange before him, accorded his distinguished inmate. There was a whole raft of other perks besides. He was able to order books at will from various antiquarian dealers in London, New York, and Boston. He was able to write uncensored letters to whomever he chose. He was able to have visitors more or less at will, and told Murray with some pride that Eliza Merritt, the widow of the man he murdered, would come to his rooms quite frequently. She was not an unattractive woman, he said, though it was thought that she drank rather too much for comfort. He subscribed to magazines, which he and Murray would read to each other. The Spectator was one of his favourites, and Outlook, which was mailed to him by his relations in Connecticut. He took the Athenaeum, as well as the splendidly arcane Oxford publication known as Notes and Queries, which even today makes puzzling inquiries of the world's literary community about unsolved mysteries of the bookish world. The OED used to publish its word desiderata there. Until Murray began visiting Crowthorne, this was Minor's principal means of finding out which particular words the OED staff were working on. Although the men talked principally about words, most often about a specific word, but sometimes about more general lexical problems of dialect or the nuances of pronunciation, they did, it's certain, discuss, in a general sense, the nature of the doctor's illness. Murray couldn't help noticing, for instance, that Minor's cell floor had been covered with a sheet of zinc, to prevent men coming in through the timbers at night, and that he kept a bowl of water beside the door of whichever room he was in, because the evil spirits will not dare cross water to get to me. Murray was aware, too, of the doctor's fears, that he'd be transported from his room at night and made to perform deeds of the wildest excess in dens of infamy before being returned to his cell by dawn. Once airplanes were invented and Minor, being American, kept keenly up to date with all that happened in the years after the Wright brothers first flew at Kitty Hawk, he incorporated them into his delusions. Men would then break into his rooms, place him in a flying machine, and take him to brothels in Constantinople, where he'd be forced to perform acts of terrible lewdness with cheap women and small girls. Murray winced as he heard these tales, but held his tongue. It was not his place to regard the old man with anything other than sad affection, and besides, his work for the dictionary continued apace. When the weather was fine, the two men would walk together on the terrace, a wide gravel path inside the asylum's south wall, shaded by tall old ferns and araucaria, the monkey puzzle tree. The lawns were green, the shrubbery filled with daffodils and tulips, and once in a while other patients would emerge from the blocks to play football, or walk, or sit staring into space from one of the wooden benches. Attendants would lurk in the shadows, making sure there were no outbreaks of trouble. Murray and Minor, hands behind their backs, would walk in step slowly back and forth along the 300 yards of the terrace, always in the shadows of either the gaunt red buildings or of the 17-foot wall. They always seemed animated, deep in conversation. Papers were produced, sometimes books. They didn't speak to others, and gave the impression of inhabiting a world of their own. Sometimes Dr. Nicholson would invite the pair in for afternoon tea, and on one or two occasions Ada Murray came to Broadmoor too, and remained with Nicholson and his family in the superintendent's comfortably furnished house, while the men pored over the books in the cell or on the gravel walkway. There was always sadness when the time came for the editor to leave. The keys would turn, the gates would clang shut, and Minor would be left alone again, trapped in a world of his own making, redeemed only when, after a day or so of quiet mourning, he could take down another volume from his shelves, select a needed word and its most elegant context, pick up his pen and dip it in the ink to write once more, "To Dr. Murray, Oxford." The Oxford post office knew the address well. It was all that was needed to communicate by letter with the greatest lexicographer in the land and to make sure the information got through to him at the scriptorium. Few enough letters between the two men survive. There's a lengthy letter from 1888 in which Minor writes about the quotations containing the word Shalloner, an obsolete name for a man who manufactured shalloon, which was a woolen lining material for coats. He's interested, according to a later note, in the word gondola, and finds a quotation from Spenser in 1590. Murray talked about his new friend often, and liked to include him, and indeed with some discreet reference to his condition, in the speeches he was often obliged to make. In 1897, for instance, his notes survived for a speech he was to give at a dictionary evening at the Philological Society. "About 15,000 or 16,000 additional slips received during the past year, half of those supplied by Dr. W. C. Minor, whose name and pathetic story I've often before alluded to. Dr. Minor has been reading 50 or 60 books, mostly scarce, of the 16th and 17th centuries. His practice is to keep just ahead of the actual preparation of the dictionary." 2 years later, Murray felt able to be more generous still. "The supreme position is certainly held by Dr. W. C. Minor of Broadmoor, who, during the past 2 years, has sent in no less than 12,000 quotations. These have nearly all been for the words which Mr. Bradley and I were actually occupied, for Dr. Minor likes to know each month just what words we are likely to be working on during the month, and to devote his whole strength to supplying quotations for those words, and thus to feel that he's in touch with the making of the dictionary. So enormous have been Dr. Minor's contributions during the past 17 or 18 years that we could easily illustrate the last 4 centuries from his quotations alone." But the devotion of his whole strength was beginning to prove taxing, both to his body and his mind. His kindly friend, Dr. Nicholson, retired in 1895, still in pain from being attacked by a patient 6 years earlier, who had hit him on the head with a brick concealed in a sock. He was replaced by a Dr. Brain, a man selected, for more than his name alone, one trusts, by a Home Office that felt a stricter regime needed to be employed at the asylum. Brain was indeed a martinet, a jailer of the old school who would have done well at a prison farm in Tasmania or Norfolk Island. But he did as the government required. There were no escapes during his term of office. There had been several before, causing widespread alarm. And in the first year, 200,000 hours of solitary confinement were logged by the more fractious inmates. He was widely feared and loathed by the patients, as well as by Dr. Murray, who thought he was treating Minor heartlessly. And Minor continues to whinge. He complains of a hole in the heel of his sock, doubtless caused by some stranger's shoe into which at night he had been obliged to place his foot. That was in November 1896. Then Minor, in December 1896, is suspicious that his wines and spirits are being tampered with. One curious snippet of information came from the United States later that same year, when it was noted rather laconically that two of Minor's family had recently killed themselves, the letter going on to warn the staff at Broadmoor that great care should be taken lest whatever madness gripped their patient turned out to have a hereditary nature. But even if the staff thought Minor a possible suicide risk, no restrictions were placed on him as a result of the American information. Some years before, he had asked for a pocket knife, with which he might trim the uncut pages of some of the first editions of the books he had ordered. There's no indication that he was asked to hand it back, even with the harsh Dr. Brain in charge. No other patient was allowed to keep a knife, but with his twin cells, his bottles and his books, and with his part-time servant, William Minor seemed still to belong to a different category from most others in Broadmoor at the time. In the year following the disclosure about his relatives, the files speak of Minor's having started to take walks out on the terrace in all weathers, angrily denouncing those who tried to persuade him to come back in during one especially violent snowstorm, insisting in his imperious way that it was his business alone if he wished to catch cold. He had more freedom of choice and movement than most. Not that this much improved his temper. A number of old army friends from America happened to come over to London in 1899, and they all asked to come to Broadmoor. But the old officer refused to see any of them, saying he didn't remember them, and besides, he didn't want to be disturbed. He formally applied to be given some freedom of the vicinage, to be let out on parole, the word vicinage that he used being rather rare and meaning essentially the same as the vicinity. The elegance of his language convinced no one, however, and that application was firmly denied. "He is still of unsound mind, and I am unable to recommend that his request be granted," the superintendent wrote to the Home Secretary. Or typed, it should be said in parenthesis. This is actually the first document in Minor's entire file that was produced on a typewriter, an indication that while the patient remained in a miserable stasis, the outside world around him was changing all too rapidly. The Home Secretary duly then turned down the prayer. On the form is added a bleak initialed notation from the heartless Dr. Brain. Patient informed, 12th December 99, R.B. His diet ticket shows him to be eating fitfully now, lots of porridge, sago pudding, custard every Tuesday, but bacon and other meat only occasionally. He appears to have become increasingly unhappy, troubled, listless. He seems unsettled is a constant theme of the attendant's notes. A visit from Murray in the summer of 1901 cheered him up, but soon afterward the staff at the dictionary were beginning to notice a depressing change in their keenest surviving volunteer. "I noticed that he sent no Q quotations," wrote Murray to a friend, "but he's been very slack altogether for many months, and I've scarcely heard anything from him. He's always less helpful in summer, because he spends so much more time in the open air, in the garden and the grounds. But this year it's worse than usual, and I've been feeling for a good while that I shall have to take a day to go and see him and try to refresh his interest. In his lonely and sad position, he requires a great deal of nursing, encouraging and coaxing, and I have had to go from time to time to see him." A month later, and things were no better. Murray wrote about him again. By now there are stories of him putting his back up and refusing to do the work that was wanted. He wrote something about the origin of the word hump, as on a camel, but aside from that, and coincident with the death of Queen Victoria, he lapsed into a sullen silence. Another old army friend, writing from Northwich in Cheshire in March 1902, asks Superintendent Brain if he might be allowed to visit Minor, telling him in some distress that Minor himself had written, saying that he ought not to, since things were much changed, and that I might find it unpleasant. "Please give me your advice," the writer adds. "I don't wish to expose my wife to anything unpleasant." but Brain agreed. "I do not think it would be advisable for you to visit. There are no indications of any immediate danger, but his years are beginning to tell on him. His life is precarious." It was at about this time that there came the first indication that it might be better if Dr. Minor now be allowed to return to the United States, to spend his declining years, as he did now seem to be in decline, close to what was left of his family. Minor had been in Broadmoor now for 30 years. He was by far the longest-staying patient. He was sustained only by his books. Sadness had utterly enveloped him. He missed the ever-sympathetic Dr. Nicholson. He was perplexed by the more brutish regime of Dr. Brain. His sole intellectual colleague among the Block 2 patients, the strange artist Richard Dadd, who had been sent to an asylum for stabbing dead his own father, had long since died himself. His own stepmother, Judith, whom he had seen briefly in 1885 on her way back from India, had also died in New Haven in 1900. Age was fast winnowing out all those who were close to the mad old man. Even old Fitzedward Hall had died in 1901, an event that prompted Minor to fire off a letter of deep and abiding sadness to Murray. Along with his condolences went a request that the editor might perhaps enclose some more slips for the letters K and O. The news of the passing of his fellow countryman seems to have revived Minor's interest in work a little, but only a little. He was now quite alone, in worsening health, harmless to all but himself. He was 66 years old and showing it. The facts of his circumstances were beginning to weigh heavily on him. Dr. Francis Brown, the distinguished physician in Boston, to whom Murray had written the full account of Minor and their first meeting, thought he might intervene. After hearing from Murray, he had written to the Department of the Army in Washington, and then to the American Embassy in London, and now in March to Dr. Brain, suggesting that, without Minor's knowledge, a petition be sent to the Home Office asking for his release into his family's custody and his return to the United States. His family would rejoice to have him spend his last days in his own land and nearer to them. But the pitiless Brain did not make the recommendation to the Home Secretary, and neither the Embassy nor the U.S. Army chose to become involved. The old man was to stay put, encouraged only by the occasional correspondence from Oxford, but increasingly dispirited, angry, and sad. A crisis was clearly about to erupt, and erupt it did. The event that in Hayden Church's orotund phrase was the most striking feature in the American's history struck without any warning that was heeded on a cold morning at the beginning of December, 1902. The unkindest cut. Masturbate. Verb. To practice self-abuse. At 10:55 a.m., Dr. Minor came to the bottom gate, which was locked, and he called out, "You'd better send for the medical officer at once. I've injured myself." These words are the first lines of a brief penciled note that lurks anonymously among the scores of other papers that measure out the trivial details of the life of Broadmoor's patient, number 742. Reports of the more mundane features of William Minor's now almost solitary life, his diet, his steadily diminishing number of visitors, his growing frailty, his curmudgeonly lapses, his insane ruminations, are usually made in ink, the writing steady and confident. But this single page, which is dated December the 3rd, 1902, is very different. The fact that it was written in thick pencil sets it apart, but so does the handwriting, which makes it look as though it was scrawled urgently, in a hurry, by a man who was breathless, panicky, in a state of shock. Its author was the Block 2 principal attendant, a Mr. Coleman. He had good reason to be appalled. "I sent Attendant Harfield for the medical officer and went to see if I could assist Dr. Minor. Then he told me he had cut his penis off. He said he had tied it with a string which had stopped the bleeding. I saw what he had done. Dr. Baker and Dr. Newt then saw him, and he was removed to the B3 infirmary at 11:30 a.m. He had taken his walk before breakfast as usual. Also, he took his breakfast. I was talking to him at 9:50 in Ward 3 when he appeared to be just as usual." But he was not, in fact, just as usual, whatever such a phrase might mean in the context of his well-developed paranoia. Unless his act of self-mutilation was an extraordinary reaction to some equally extraordinary event, which could be the case, though there is no proof of it, it looks very much as though William Minor had been planning it for several days, if not for months. Cutting off his penis was, by his lights, a necessary and redemptive act. It had probably come about as the consequence of a profound religious awakening, which his doctors believed had begun 2 years before, or at the end of the century, 30 years after he had been committed.